spirit. I had that cued, but we just simply don't have time. I got to wish you all well. Have a good week. Stay tuned. The detail is coming up next.
Hi, this is Ken, and you are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota.
From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, this is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Thursday, April 18th. Bob Graham died Tuesday at age 87. The two-term Florida governor, who went on to serve in the U.S. Senate, passed away with wife Adele and other family by his side in a retirement community in Gainesville. Graham's legacy includes protection for the Everglades and other natural assets in the state, the public colleges and universities he championed with his commitment to higher education, and his down-to-earth persona with work days he created joining people doing their jobs. His family said that in his more than 400 work days, Graham was one of the most popular figures in Florida politics over the past half century. After representing part of Miami-Dade County in the state Senate, Graham was elected governor in 1978, winning a Democratic runoff and then easily defeating Republican Jack Eckerd in the general election. In 1986, Graham defeated a Republican incumbent senator and went on to serve three terms in Washington. His tenure included chairing the Senate Intelligence Committee after the September 11 attacks. He opposed the Iraq invasion and ran on that when he pursued the Democratic presidential nomination in 2004. Graham did not seek a fourth term in the Senate that year. At a meeting on Tuesday, the Sarasota School Board approved an agreement with a company that provides an AI program to help students improve their writing and critical thinking skills. The program, called PackBack, also helps teachers with grading and coaching. PackBack will be used in 9th and 10th grade classrooms. Early this month, the district approved a new AI policy stating that students should not use artificial intelligence platforms to avoid doing their own work, and that AI should only be used as a supplement when allowed by a teacher. A conference titled Talavast at 20 this Saturday will talk about what has and has not happened in the two decades since news broke that a military contractor contaminated the groundwater in that African-American town in South Manatee County. The conference on the campus of USF Sarasota Manatee is free and open to the public, but registration is required. For details, look for the link on our report of the conference on WSLR.org. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Thursday, April 18th.
Welcome to The Detail. I'm your host, Kathy Antunes, and you are listening to The Detail on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. With me today is Jessica Thomason. She is what I would call a plugged-in parent who has been paying attention to the school board. Jessica, tell us about yourself. How long have you been in Sarasota? What do you do?
Well, I've been in Sarasota for 14, almost 15 years. Okay. So before I had kids, my husband and I came down. I'm from Florida originally, but I went up to Virginia for school. I'm a pharmacist, so I went up there to get, you know, my pharmacy degree and came back down. Couldn't take more than four winters, and so I came back. So I have two kids, a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old. And they're both in there. I have one in a public school, one in a charter school, public charter. Mm-hmm. They're my big focus. And then, you know, somehow about a year and a half ago, I sort of started getting plugged in, like you said, to what's going on with the school board. And I was really kind of shocked at how much on the local level is so politicized, because prior to that, you know, my kids have a great school experience. Things are, you know, I think a lot of parents, things are going well for their kids at their school, and that's what they're focused on.
Sure.
And then when something goes wrong or something is off and you start paying attention, it opens a door to a world you did not know existed. And mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what happened for me. Okay. So.
Yeah. Where did you go to school in Virginia? I went to school in Virginia, so I'm curious.
Well, it's a little school, Shenandoah University. I went to their little, they actually have a really great conservatory, but I was at the Bernard J. Dunn School of Pharmacy.
Okay.
And it was it's beautiful up there. We loved it, but it was definitely like, you know, the winters were way too long. I mean, it's still considered the South, but to me, it was practically like Canada or something.
Like,
so it was
north,
nice, but
yeah
it was a little much. I was like, it's March, why is it cold still, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
But it was beautiful. It was a great experience. It was not, it was actually, it made me appreciate some things about Florida that I didn't maybe before, but it also opened my eyes to things about Florida that are not so great. So it was a good experience.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to have. I've lived all over the country too, and it gives you a broad perspective, right, about what's possible,
right,
and what's going on. So, you know, I became aware of your advocacy and your, you know, paying attention to the school board when you posted a video online. And obviously, what's gone on with the school boards and what's gone on with Bridget Ziegler in particular has been controversial. People are calling for her to step down. And that drumbeat has been ongoing. But this was something that I didn't catch. And I didn't, you know, I don't watch all meetings all the time or every minute of every meeting. And it's very useful to have the eyes of the community on what's going on. And that's pretty much what you did. Do you, before I set up this, you know, show the clip of what you recorded, and then I want to read the letter that you sent to the school board. How did you come to decide, hey, I want people to know about this?
Well, somebody texted me, who is somebody that is not necessarily quite as plugged in, but they do pay attention. And they had heard, they saw someone else post, Bridget Ziegler wants immigrant children to be tracked, you know, which sounds kind of headline-y. Like, mm-hmm. I thought that can't be right. And she said, is this true? And I was like, okay, well, I'm not all the way through the workshop, because usually I'm working during the workshops. And so I might listen a little bit, you know, people are working,
most
right? And
are.
It's always during the day.
Sure.
So I'll usually, you know, I'll catch a little bit of it at work, but then I'll try over the course of the next few days to listen. Usually at night, you know, before I go to sleep, I'm trying to listen to all of it over mm-hmm. the course of time. And I said, where did they hear this? You know, and so I start looking and trying to figure out, when did she say this? It's nothing they talked about. It wasn't like an agenda item. And so I find it in member comments. So if you don't have time to listen to an entire board meeting, a workshop, fast forward to member comments, because you find a lot of little hidden Easter eggs in member comments, because it's sort of that time where anybody can just sort of float an idea. And that's kind of where that's where Vermilion came from, you know,
mm-hmm.
the whole, mm-hmm. that whole thing.
That's
so I find it.
That is a really great tip. Because if you want to know what the school board members are thinking, member mm-hmm. comments is a great place to go. Yeah,
it is. You get a little preview into what's coming. So, you know, I fast forward to it and I listen, and I could not believe what I was hearing. And I think a lot of people probably did miss it, because even if you do listen to the workshop, very few people are listening to every word, you know, and paying full 100% attention. And you can't, that's not a realistic expectation. But luckily, you know, being involved in school board stuff, I have kind of surrounded myself with a lot of people paying attention. So when a lot of people are paying attention, someone is gonna notice. And so I didn't find it, I wasn't the first to notice it, but I just could not, I thought, I don't know, I mean, I'm no lawyer, right? But I was like, this doesn't even sound legal. Let me Google it, which is, you know, didn't take long. And suddenly I knew more about education law than Bridget Ziegler, who's been on the board for 10 years.
Let's talk about that. So that's great. So this was basically something through the course of conversation on social media you became aware of. Let's play Let's play this for people because you really have to hear what's happening. Okay. So this is actually posted in the Facebook group, Citizens for Sarasota County, where on social media, we share information about what's going on in local politics. And, you know, it's a nonpartisan group. You do have to live in Sarasota County to not necessarily to be a member, but to participate. So here we go. This is the members' comments, March 19th, the Sarasota School Board work session.
The way as possible.
Mrs. Ziegler. Thank you. I had a similar, we'd asked a question. I had a couple of people recently ask me this and I don't know what the answer is. So there's been an influx of different language, many students who speak different, coming from different countries, I believe, and the language barriers that are existing. Do we have any track, like, do we keep track of students coming in, different languages that they have? Do we have any sense of, like, immigration status or anything like that? Do we keep track of that?
Immigration status, no. In terms of doing a language survey, yes. So okay. We know what languages are coming to us. In terms of status, we don't have that information.
Well, I know that, but I didn't know if there is a way to calculate that, because there's just been a lot of questions with people in the community and what have you, and I've heard both from staff and, well, I guess members of the community in general, about a concern about being able to respond to the language barriers, but also it kind of becoming more of a burden than usual. I don't know if that is, are we seeing more than usual, or is that just the perception? Is there a way to evaluate that
Without giving any inaccurate information now, I'll definitely take that back.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Enos?
Okay, so that was the piece that you brought forward and said, hey, wait a minute. It was concerning to bring up immigration status, as you found out that actually is not a legal thing. So I will just read your letter to Bridget. Okay, Mrs. Ziegler, at the end of today's work session, during member comments, you asked Superintendent Connor if we know the immigration status of students, as you're concerned about the potential burden on the school district. When he said no, you self-corrected and admitted that you know we don't actually track it, but wanted to know if it could be done and asked him to look into that. I heard several board members today express how all they really want to do is get back to business and focus on the students and quit with all the distractions. And so I thought I'd try and save you all a little time and perhaps save Mr. Connor the unnecessary task of doing your homework for you. Under the 1982 Supreme Court ruling, Plyler versus Doe, it was determined that denying children access to public education was a 14th Amendment violation. All students, regardless of immigration status, have a right to education. And you post the link to that decision. Again, that's on Citizens for Sarasota County. In addition, the state of Florida has no authority to even ask students about their immigration status. If you need further clarification on the federal laws protecting education access for all children in the United States, you may refer to the federal statute. Again, you link the statute and read this frequently asked questions on the ACLU's website. I would really hate for your ignorance to land our district in legal trouble. I know how important it was to this board to avoid legal fees when the latest charter school was reluctantly approved. I understand that the reason you're asking this is so that you can come up with a handy statistic for political use. The border is a hot topic right now, and you fully intend to capitalize on it. Often the public is told to, quote, take it to Tallahassee, unquote, and insert issue is out of the board's jurisdiction. Well, Mrs. Ziegler, this is most certainly out of your jurisdiction, but you can feel free to take it to Washington, D.C. I also couldn't help but notice when you said this concern had been brought up to you by a few members of the community. It's so funny, though, because hundreds of members of the community have asked you to resign, and you don't want to seem to listen to that. Have a great night, Jessica Thomason. So that's a pretty direct letter.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not the first letter I've written the board, you know, and I don't expect responses or anything like that. But it, to me, it just, it was so clear what she was doing. It was such an obvious attempt to scapegoat immigrant children, knowing that there is this sort of national focus on the southern border. But there's just so many, I mean, I don't even know where to begin with it. For one thing, enrollment is down. Enrollment is projected to be down. We do not have an influx of children, period, much less immigrants, much less undocumented immigrants. So it just seemed like such an odd choice, just an odd statement. And it also felt very convenient coming on the heels of, you know, the don't say gay clarification and that whole settlement, because it feels very much like, okay, we've been targeting the LGBTQ kids and that's kind of not working out. We need someone else to blame. We know funding is going to be drastically cut this year. It's not good and we don't know how bad, but it's down. And we need someone to blame. And it certainly can't be her, even though she would presumably be receiving voucher money because her children attend private school. So she's eligible for $24,000, but we won't talk about her draining our system. Let's find some sort of like faceless, vague, you know, these children, you know, that supposedly exist in our schools.
Yeah.
But the whole thing is just so, it's just so obvious to me. And it's like, I think she kind of banks on people maybe not paying that much attention. Or maybe she knows we do and just doesn't care. Throw whatever at the wall and see what sticks. But
yeah. So good. When you're talking about the draining of resources, you're specifically talking about universal vouchers and
largely. I mean, there's other things, but that's a big. I don't feel like the district really wants to talk about it, in part because a lot of it is a projection. But it's a large amount of money. I mean, I know Bonnie Penner was interviewed recently, I think as part of WSLR, if I have that right.
Okay.
But, you know, she had some numbers. And I think the difference between last year's vouchers and the upcoming, the projection, it amounts to, it was like 1,744 more vouchers going out. And it's taking us from, I think somewhere in the 20 million range all the way to a $37 million loss to the district. That's real money. That, I mean, it's a $14 million increase in vouchers going out next year. Now that's not 100% set in stone. That is a projection, but I mean, it is going to be a substantial amount of money, and that has zero to do with immigration at all. I mean, it's a huge sum of money. I know that our Title I funding is down. I recently talked to some people at the district, and based on projections due to, you know, they're just the population is just fewer children, but also fewer people, so, you know, a little bit of a decrease in the students that are actually eligible for free and reduced lunch. So the number that would qualify as Title I. So that's a little bit too, but the bottom line is like this idea of having this influx, it's not happening.
So Title I funding, can you just share what that is for people listening?
Yeah, so I'll do my best because I'm just sort of a layperson myself, but it's basically, it's federal funding that is sent, you know, from the federal government to the state that's then allocated to different districts who have students who reach a certain poverty level. So Title I refers to the school, I think, not the student itself. So you would have a school, if if a certain percentage, I don't know what that percentage is, but if a certain percentage, a pretty high percentage, is eligible for free and reduced lunch, which basically means they're living on a very low income.
Yeah.
Then if you reach that certain threshold percentage at your school, then you're a Title I school. And Title I schools receive additional funding from the federal government to help basically offset the extra cost, because it does cost more to provide services to students that are facing a variety of issues like homelessness or, you know, lack of resources at home. You're feeding them, you're providing just extra, you know, you might have more paras, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully I explained that kind of well.
Yeah. No, you did. You did. And it's great to see. I mean, you've got two children in the school district, right? You said an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, this is the kind of educated advocacy that it's great to see. To see more and more parents understanding what's going on. What I found concerning, because I think the brand of politics that we've seen in Sarasota for a while now, I would say before it became a more national phenomenon, it was already here. But the scapegoat factor, right? Let's find someone to blame. And the Supreme Court decision that you link, essentially, you know, when you're talking about, this is the thing I find kind of soulless about it all, is these are kids.
Right.
Children who speak a foreign language, right, aren't choosing where they live. Their parents choose for them. But in this country, under, you know, the decision that you linked to Plyler versus Doe, the Supreme Court has decided that under the Constitution of the United States, children have a right to an education regardless of their immigration status. I would expect that's largely because they're innocent of whatever's going on in terms of, you know, are they documented? Are they undocumented? And it is a wise investment for any society to invest in children who live here, you know?
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely. And the thing to remember too is that, you know, there's a process going on, and many of these children will remain in this country. And so, I mean, the way I look at it, if a child is here, then they are our responsibility while they're here. Whatever ends up happening with their immigration status is beside the point. You know, if the child is in our jurisdiction, I guess you would say, you know, that is our, I feel that that's our collective responsibility. And it's very interesting to, you know, to hear these arguments from the right, who are so, you know, supposedly pro-life and liberty and all of these things. And then you want to tell a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, we're not teaching you ABCs. And honestly, the sooner that you get the children into school, the easier it will be for them to learn English and to be able to, you know, sort of join in their English speaking peers. It's much harder to take maybe a 6th or 7th grader who speaks no English and then sort of try to catch them up and keep them on level. So it just does not, the messaging is so all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just thinly veiled, in my opinion. It's just a completely prejudicial take. I mean, you know, if it's convenient, then we love children. If it's not convenient, we don't care about children. It's bizarre to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then frankly, it's like, however you feel about it, bringing it up here is completely irrelevant, because I feel like the push will be to make this part of the school board election, you know, narrative of like of sort of making this kind of like a left and right thing. And the bottom line is, it doesn't matter who is elected to school board. This is not going to change in Sarasota. This is something that I know that the governor of Texas wants to change, and maybe that's something that will be fought and attempted to be overturned. I don't know, but it's not going to happen in Sarasota. And, you know, Bridget needs to focus on the students here and doing the best for them instead of sort of trying to sort of demonize or otherize these kids. No, she knows that this is not, she knows that this is not the problem we're facing. It's yeah. So disingenuous.
So I'm curious to get your thoughts about the disingenuous take you have, right? On how it was framed. And, you know, being in sales, and Mrs. Ziegler was in sales for actually many years. If you're good at it, you understand the power of language and how you ask a question and how you pose things and how you listen. I have some thoughts about it, but I think the manner in which it was introduced is interesting. What did you think about how she framed this issue?
Well, you can tell as soon as she starts speaking, you can sense there's a discomfort. There's this, I need to say this in just the right way. I need to say something that is coming from an ill-intentioned place and somehow frame it to sound like my concern is for the teachers, the burden that they might face, or I'm just asking the question. And I feel like that's a very common way to sort of introduce a bad idea, is sort of, oh, I'm just asking. I'm not going to claim anything, but I'm just going to float the question out there. And so she stumbles around with her words, kind of, you know, well, people from different speaking language, you know, not sure how she wants to phrase it. And so she kind of saves herself a little bit and is like, well, you know, different languages that are coming in. So I'm listening intently and I'm like, okay, that's legitimate. We do need to know what languages are coming in. I'm also a substitute teacher, right? And I've substituted, and I am, yeah. And I did it because I had this old dream of being a teacher as a kid for very many reasons. I could never be a full-time teacher. But I do feel like it helps a lot with my advocacy. And it just gives me an insight into what the reality is in schools versus, you know, it's one thing to talk about things in a sort of vague, on paper way. But then when you see what's in the classroom, you kind of get it. So I substituted for a class where there was a child who spoke Portuguese, and no one spoke Portuguese at the school. The Spanish speaking kids did have, you know, I'm not going to say they had enough resources, but they're, you know, it's a common foreign language here. So the resources are pretty, pretty good. But with this particular child, it was a struggle. But I wasn't like, oh, this is such a struggle for me. I thought this is a struggle for her, because I can't really keep her engaged if I can't even communicate in the most basic way with her. She really did need a little bit of one-on-one. But, you know, those are legitimate concerns, like which languages are we seeing? Are we meeting the needs? Because you do have some outliers where there's not a ton of Portuguese. Like we have a lot of Ukrainian and a lot of Spanish, you know, but then there's some that are not as well represented. Okay. And so meeting their needs, I get that. That's something we want to know. So I hear that and I'm like, all right. But when she said immigration status, I thought, what, for one thing, what is the status? Whether a child is here legally or illegally, okay, the language they speak is the same. So the burden, as she calls it, I mean, I understand why she's asking, but I'm interested to hear her, you know, how she would package her reasoning, because it's totally irrelevant to, you know, how that affects our schools. Now, I know that she would probably say it's a financial burden. But the truth is, like I said, the Title I funding is down. You know, a lot of undocumented children, I would imagine, are, you know, living in poverty or close to it. So if you had an influx, our Title I funding would be up. Secondly, you know, the other two big sources of funding are property tax and sales tax. Well, everyone who lives here pays sales tax. Everyone who buys anything pays sales tax. So the undocumented families are paying state sales tax, which then comes back to our county. I looked this up before our interview because I was curious. I thought, well, you know, what about property tax? I was shocked to read. Now, this is a 2014. I could not find anything that was more recent than this, but there was a 2014. It's a Migration Policy Institute analysis, and they said 31% of undocumented immigrants are homeowners. in America. 31%, I thought it would be far lower than that. And they don't even qualify for like the special, what is it? Is it an FHA? Like, what is the popular loan that's such a good deal?
FHA.
They don't get that. So they're either paying cash or getting some kind of like, there was something called an ITIN loan. You know, they have other, you know, means that they go about financing a home, but they're also paying property tax. And then that doesn't even begin to touch the fact that they're truly the backbone of the economy when it comes to like agriculture in Florida and service work and construction. I mean, nobody wants to talk because let's be real. If we either gave them a pathway to citizenship and had to pay them a living wage or actually, you know, deported all of these people, our economy would collapse. So that's the reality of it. But even if you want to make the argument that it's a financial burden, that's simply not true.
Yeah, you know, I thought, well, your point about cheap labor, you know, there's this kind of split or dissociated thinking because the society benefits from people coming in doing the jobs that other people don't want to do or, you know, people born in the United States, you've heard this a lot, you know, nobody who was born here actually wants to do these jobs. The immigrants come in hungry for an opportunity and they do them, right? And they do them because this country was founded on cheap labor. And, you know, the people who are paying a lower wage benefit from the cheaper labor, you know, benefit from the lower wage. That is just the reality. But to get back to her wordsmithing and method of framing the issue, it was almost like this very casual, I'm confused. Oh, I don't know this. Oh, but I do know this. But, you know, is there any way we can track this? You know, I'm just asking. I'm kind of confused. And then the nameless, faceless community people who are asking about this, there's never actually any concrete evidence that anybody ever has asked about this. You know, it just rings like a potential, it's like, okay, is this the next culture war that we can look to her, the Moms for Liberty, and the DeSantis agenda washing up on our school board shores, you know, now.
Right.
The other stuff.
Right. I mean, she,
you know.
Yeah, I think she's desperate to make herself relevant. She's, you know, she has lost some clout within her own circles. And yeah, I actually did a public records request to see, you know, what emails were sent to the board, Bridget or any of the board members, with the words, you know, immigration status or concerns about too many people speaking foreign languages and the burden on, you know, I gave a list of words. I'm waiting to hear, not because I want to dox anyone. And I really don't like that on either side. I mean, people have a right to petition their government and ask questions. But my suspicion is that there are either no emails asking that question or the emails come from a very select and very predictable group of people that are constantly stirring the same pot with Bridget. And so, you know, I don't think we're going to be getting a big giant list of emails asking her about immigration status of students. It's just not, there's no way. It's just not going to happen. I think she's, it's obviously an attempt to kind of usher in a new argument, I guess, as far as who are we going to blame all of our problems on? Because it certainly couldn't be anything we're doing as a board.
It couldn't be her.
It can't be that.
And, you know, well, everybody, if you just joined us, you're listening to The Detail on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. Programming at WSLR is supported by listeners like you and by Ringling College Galleries and Exhibitions. Ringling College's 2023-24 exhibition season features art from Ringling students, alumni, faculty, and nationally recognized artists from a wide range of mediums and from diverse backgrounds. More information is available at ringlingcollege.gallery. Jessica Thomason is my guest. She's a parent. She's a advocate for public schools. She's been watching the Sarasota County School Board in a highly efficient way. I'm really impressed at your follow-up and your tips on how to watch these meetings effectively. You said, go to the member comments during the workshops. That's where you get to see what school board members are thinking. That's a great tip. Jessica, what has the response been? Because what you did was so helpful. You just put the video up of the piece of the meeting that raised your concern, and then you also included your letter to Bridget Ziegler. Did you ever get a response, by the way, to your letter?
No, I won't hold my breath for responses. I think very rarely will I ever, but with an email like that, I know that I'm not going to, but it's, they read it. Someone read it.
I've asked Bridget Ziegler on this show many times. I will ask her publicly now. She is always welcome to come and have an hour to explain her philosophy. She knows I don't agree with everything that she's doing, but she has that opportunity. I mean, I don't bite, and I'm sure an email to a constituent, does she expect them all to be, you know, rainbows? And I mean, there's going to be people who write in who don't like what's happening. What was the response that you've gotten from your neighbors or other parents to what you put out there regarding her, you know, asking the superintendent about following up on the number of kids who speak foreign languages? She did ask about immigration status. He told her, no, we don't track that. And she was like, oh, wait, I know that. But right. Also, I think to her characterizing an influx of children who speak foreign languages, which you say is highly unlikely, given funding markers, things that would indicate that. But characterizing these children as a burden, that I found, wow. What did others respond to your...
I think it obviously brought some attention to it. People were upset and pretty shocked that she would say that. And I also think, you know, the main thing is that it really opened up a dialogue. A lot of people, I will be honest, that prior to this workshop, I didn't know, and I had never heard of Plyler versus Doe. I think in the back of my mind, I was under the impression that you can't discriminate against children regardless of immigration status, but I don't know where I got that impression. I didn't know anything for sure. So now I've educated myself, that's allowed me to educate others. You know, it's caused me to look into some things I wasn't aware of, and it's gotten conversations going among parents. And, you know, what's really nice is, I will admit, you know, I'm mostly surrounded by people that are more liberal that do think like me, but I also am friends with people that are more conservative. And it's allowed us to have some conversations like what we've had, where we really talk about the reality of what, you know, what immigration looks like in reality versus sort of the narrative that you might hear from certain news outlets and whatnot. And so it has really created an opportunity and a space for me to have some conversations with people that I would not have otherwise had, that I think are very productive conversations. And then it's also, you know, a lot of people have shared with me and with other people, you know, surrounding this letter and this clip, their own immigration story. People that, you know, a friend of mine, her mother fled, you know, a foreign country, and she was in a domestic violence situation. Drug cartel situation. She came here with my friend as a child. I don't know if they were documented or not documented, but the point is that, you know, she was that child who was so grateful to have the opportunity to feel safe in America. And now that person is an incredible teacher. She was nominated for Teacher of the Year at her school a few years back. She's a huge inspiration to me, and she is able to use the experience she had as a child to inform the way that she teaches, and, you know, her own empathy and just the things that she's providing to our children, I will tell you this, that teacher does not view any of these children as a burden. And I don't think any of us should, regardless of what language they speak. I do understand that, you know, it is a challenge, of course, as you get additional languages that don't have the population that would then justify funding for, say, an ESL teacher that's specifically for this language or that. But to me, I almost want to say to her, you know, maybe I'm misjudging you. Maybe what you were going to do is find out about all the different languages we're seeing and then start a campaign to get federal funding for extra ESL, or ask for volunteers to come in our school, which I know that my child's school does. We have some volunteers. I think some come in and speak Ukrainian, just translators or someone to sit with the kids, read with them, because we don't have someone who is just dedicated Ukrainian ESL. You know, so I get, maybe you can use this opportunity, Bridget, to advocate for these children. Because here's the thing, most likely those children will be here in 10, 20 years. Some of them might not be, but many of them will be. Many of them will be legal. You know, you don't know where they are in their path to citizenship. You have no idea. Right. But we owe them an opportunity to be educated and informed. And how you treat them is going to make the difference. I really don't think she wants them to be informed or educated or be able to advocate for themselves. You know, education, if you go all the way back to slavery, no one wanted slaves to be educated. Why? Because that's power. Understanding your civic responsibilities and your the world that you're living in and how to advocate and how to communicate and organize. People don't want you to do that if they want to control you, you know? So I don't want to get too, you know, too in the weeds with that, but that to me is why education is so fundamental and should automatically be given to anyone who is living in our borders. You know, just full stop.
Yeah, you know, I think that, it's interesting because this issue, immigration, has evolved into a continuous stick that to be used to flog people with politically. But as we see in, you know, Congress, the Republican Party negotiated an immigration deal with the Democrats and then refused to do it. Why? Because they want the issue to, it's about inflaming people. Right.
So 100%.
Yeah, I would think that I'm sure that if we asked Bridget if she would ever agree to come on and talk about anything, but if I asked Bridget Ziegler about this, I expect she would tell me, oh, no, I care about the kids. Right. They all say they care about the kids. But the the strategy for a long time has been agitation. And it's one thing when it's national, that's not good. But when you're bringing it into schools, that's really something else entirely. And there are children who get hurt by this strategy. In a way, it's like we talk about anti-bullying on a macro level. Of course, we're against bullying, of course. But if this is the kind of rhetoric you're using to differentiate students from each other and getting their parents worked up about it, something that may actually be a non-issue, or isn't that a form of bullying? In what? In the winning elections.
Exactly. It's very similar to kind of like Donald Trump's playbook. It's like, well, I'm not the one storming the Capitol. I'm just basically encouraging people to do it. I mean, but I didn't do anything. You know, it's also kind of the narrative we've heard about, well, there's no LGBTQ children being harmed in our schools because we don't have a local story like Next Benedict yet. So if that hasn't happened, we didn't do anything.
Hang on a second, just so people know, Next Benedict is a child who was found dead, and I might have been self-harm. She was bullied by other students, or I think, yeah, I'm not sure the pronouns,
right.
But anyway, yeah, it was a very, very sad situation. And wherever people are as human beings, they should feel safe in school.
Right, exactly. And really that kind of stuff starts at the top. I mean, bullying happens regardless of what's going on in government. I mean, you're never going to eliminate every form of bullying, but you know, when you see the behavior of the board and the narrative of people like Bridget Ziegler on a national stage, I mean, she's not just our problem. She's a much bigger problem than just Sarasota. But when you see your government does not even really care about protecting you or respecting you at all, will not advocate you, will not do the bare minimum to keep you safe, that empowers bullies to essentially feel completely entitled to treat you however they want, and you know that you don't have the upper hand. And this sort of, you know, Robin Marinelli is another one who has said, you know, well, I haven't heard of people being harmed, but it's like every week there are actual students giving you firsthand account of how they feel harmed and how they don't feel safe. And it's like, have you guys even stepped foot into any of these schools? I know that, you know, once in a while we'll get sort of a photo op of the board members reading during literacy week. But other than that, you know, Tom Edwards is the only school board member who is regularly in the schools, you know, showing support for the teachers, the students. This idea that, you know, well, we're not harming anyone. You're sitting on the dais and you're spouting all of this very divisive language. It's completely absurd to say that there's no harm coming from that. They know better.
So, you know, I wanted to ask you, as a parent of an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old, and I'm curious because one of your kids goes to a charter school, and I've often mm-hmm. said on the program, you know, this isn't a black and white issue with charter schools. There are very right. effective, helpful charter schools. And then, you know, there's a for-profit aspect to it that can be detrimental. What has your experience been? Is this a corporate charter school that your child goes to? Is it more of a homegrown charter school? You know, I'm not going to ask you to name it the school if you're not comfortable, but have you been happy? And what's your take on charter schools?
Yeah, so I'm happy to tell you, she goes to SSAS in right downtown.
Okay, so that's a locally formed, homegrown charter school.
Sarasota, yes, and so right,
yeah,
exactly. It's not a corporate situation. We've had a really great experience there. You know, middle school is a tough time for sure.
Yeah,
and so you know, we looked at different options. We were looking at Booker Middle because she's kind of really into dance and the arts. And then she ended up really liking SSAS when we toured it. And so we went with that, and it's been really great. I think that, you know, what's interesting, and I don't want to put SSAS in the spotlight too much, but in the environment that we've been in lately, SSAS was one of the only schools that was still doing like the celebrating our differences field trip. You know, they, if anything, they're more on the, to me, I felt there was more freedom at that school. Yeah. Right. And like the books that she was able to read were currently taken out of public schools because there was just too much unknown about what's legal, what's not. And so, you know, it's funny. Sometimes you think of charter schools as sort of, I tend to think of them as being more right-leaning or not so much of a public good, but that's not always the case. I mean, mm-hmm. like you said, a homegrown charter is very different than a corporate. Now, I still think that there are issues with, you know, there's not as much oversight. So I do have an experience with another charter school, and I won't name them, that my kids used to go to when they were very young. And it was a, it's not for profit, but there were some things that happened there that felt like, you know, like kind of good old boys. You know, the board is made up of just like friends of the principal. There's really not true oversight. Mm-hmm. And that bothers me. And so I've seen it, but at the same time, that school does offer, it's a very niche school that is really great for certain kids. I think that when a charter school is able to offer something that is unique, that is a niche situation, something that the district is not currently offering, when they're able to service a population that otherwise would not maybe have that same opportunity. So where they're located makes a difference. What kind of transportation they offer, what, you know, do you offer a schedule that's different? I don't think we offer this here, but as an example, like you might have a charter that chooses to do year-round school. And so I like that it does offer parents some different opportunities, and you don't have that kind of very corporate, you know, sometimes people think of public schools as just like they're all the same and everything is almost like it's this prison environment. I don't think we have that so much in Sarasota, but mm-hmm. but I can see where if something is fully publicly run and you have no options, you kind of lose the ability to have a little extra creativity or maybe do things in an out of the box way. But, you know, when you start getting into the territory of clearly for profit, they're not even, you know, it's not even like they're hiding it. Okay. It's just, we're here to make a dime. Like you have Charters USA is the name of it. The recent one that was approved.
Yeah.
For profit. They did not even have.
Yeah.
They didn't even have a real presentation, but.
Yeah. So you referenced that in your letter to Bridget Ziegler, and, you know, just for the time we have left, what, you know, you must have watched that hearing. You're certainly familiar with it. And what is your take on that whole situation with the charter school application and how the school board handled it from Charter Schools USA?
Okay, so Charter School USA, I think they also have a charter in Welland Park that when you go back a year, the board unanimously agreed that they did not want the charter school there. But then very soon after that, the legislation changed where now the state pretty much decides and the local districts don't really have the opportunity to decide what works in their district.
So I'm gonna stop you there. What the state has introduced is the opportunity to appeal. And some of the appeals have been overturned, but some of them, the local school board decision has been upheld. So it's not a slam dunk that the state's going to overturn a decision, but the state has also said if it is overturned, you're responsible for the legal fees. So there's kind of a mercenary aspect to it. Where
right.
the school district would be on the hook for legal fees if it got overturned. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So it's kind of like, you know, if you're going to deny a charter, you have to be pretty sure that you can justify it. You know, you don't have as much, I guess, leeway and you know, using the district's own personal, you know, your environment and your community informs your decisions, I would hope, as a board and what schools would work for your community. So now that there's more state control over that, or as you said, you know, charters have the opportunity to appeal. And I guess that the board members looked at the situation that they were dealt in. And I think most of them, I don't know about Bridget, but even Robin and definitely Tim Enos, expressed some real reservations with the school. They didn't like it. They didn't like the lack of presentation. They didn't like all the things that were still up in the air, just a lot of problems. But what they all said was that, look, we are going to very likely lose in an appeal situation, and we expect that they would appeal a decision if we deny it. And then we would have to pay our own legal fees plus theirs. And so, like you said, it is kind of a mercenary situation. Like, are we gonna really go for this or not? I do understand that, you know, you have to be fiscally responsible with taxpayer money. I get where they're coming from. But I do think Tom Edwards was the only one who didn't vote for it. I spoke at that board meeting and I said to them, basically, you know, I understand that this feels like a Hail Mary, like we can't win this, but you allow, when you have a, when you have a government that is attempting to be authoritarian, and this is not my quote, it's someone else's who I don't have in front of me, but you're showing them how much power they can have when you proactively comply with everything they want. And so to me, I would like to see our district be financially responsible, of course, but I think it is worth it to fight for our district and say, you know what, we are going to appeal this, and this is why. And I do think that that's a valuable use of taxpayer money, because what happens is the parents that really maybe aren't informed and do send their kids to this school that is not A grade, we will end up absorbing a lot of those kids into the public schools when things aren't working out so well at the charter.
Yeah.
And then we have to catch them up.
Yeah. It's interesting because there are people who are very well versed in these applications who do feel that the weaknesses there were, you know, problematic enough that there was a very good case. This is for the charter school, the Classical Preparatory Academy Charter School that was approved. There was, of course, Mrs. Ziegler has a connection with the Classical Academy. It was at the same address as the current Classical Academy. Supposedly two different schools, that's what they said, but, you know, raises reasonable questions. I find it very odd that the taxes paid for education are local taxes. You know, this isn't a Tallahassee. I don't see how Tallahassee gets to dictate how a local community spends their local dollars on education. We actually have, you know, the Constitution of Florida mandates that school board members act in the local interest, and yet Tallahassee's overruling them. Very different from the Republican Party I grew up with. Completely different. This just would
absolutely
not, would not be. So we need to wrap it up. Jessica, what are your concerns moving forward with the school board? You know, you're in the heart of raising two kids. They're 8 and 12. They've got a good bit of time, and these are critical years for their education. What do you want to see happen with the school board?
Well, I think the most pressing thing, I don't expect Bridget Ziegler to step down. She's not actually my primary concern, because I think that even her fellow board members, with the exception of Karen Rose, are wise to what she's doing. I don't think they trust her necessarily. But I think Karen Rose and her connection with Bridget, she has voted with Bridget on things like Vermillion. I think she's more in line with Bridget, and because she's the chair and because she's up for re-election, she is my primary focus. I think we need to vote her out and sort of start to shift the makeup of this board. Because although I don't agree with, like, Tim Enos, I don't agree with him on a lot, but I think he is level-headed. I don't think that he is malicious. Okay, when it comes to Karen Rose and some of her connections, I don't want to get too deep into that. I'm very concerned about that. So in the short term, replacing Karen Rose and re-electing Tom Edwards. So vote for Liz Barker and re-elect Tom Edwards is what I would like to see. Just to start to have a more moderate, reasonable voice, on the board, at least, you know, I don't think we should not have Republicans on the board, but we need people who are truly there to see, to support public education. We may not agree on how we do it, but to me, to sit on the board, you should truly care about helping public education for the children in your district. Bare minimum, please, you know.
Well, Jessica Thomason, I appreciate the work you're doing to advocate for public education. You're an involved parent who's paying attention to the school board. You brought forward something very important that I think the community response was very interested and strong. And this is the kind of engagement that leads to good schools and good government and good conversations. So I thank you for that. And everybody, you have been listening to The Detail on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. Programming at WSLR is supported by listeners like you and by the Ringling College Galleries and Exhibitions. Ringling College's 2023-24 exhibition season features art from Ringling students, alumni, faculty, and nationally recognized artists from a wide range of mediums and from diverse backgrounds. More information is available at ringlingcollege.gallery, and be sure to stay tuned for more public affairs programming here on WSLR. Make it a great day.
Democracy Now!, you're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
My question to you, are mobs shouting from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, or long live the infantata? Are those anti-Semitic comments?
When I hear those terms, I find them very upsetting.
The president of Columbia University is grilled at a congressional hearing about anti-Semitism on campus and what critics call the silencing of pro-Palestinian voices. We'll be joined by two Barnard Columbia professors. One of them signed an open letter from Jewish professors calling the hearings a new McCarthyism. But first, the University of Southern California cancels the commencement address of its valedictorian for what it claimed were safety reasons after she became the subject of an online anti-Palestinian hate campaign.
I was contacted by the administration on Monday, actually this past Monday, shortly before the statement was released, that I would unfortunately no longer be allowed to give the commencement address for the class of 2024.
We'll speak with Asna Tabassum. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.